5 years ago, on Mother's Day, I bled from my face while holding back tears in a parking lot behind a sushi place I'd never wanted to visit. It wasn't supposed to go that way. Not that day. He had been to therapy. He read the books, said the right things, breathed through his nose like the counselor taught him. And for a while, he seemed better. I had almost believed him. We had a daughter together, and for her sake, I let myself believe in second chances. So when I asked, gently, "Can we go to Brio for Mother's Day? Their mushroom ravioli is my favorite," I didn't expect a storm. He twisted his mouth, like I insulted his bloodline. "We should go to Ota. Best sushi in the state," he said, his voice calm, but already tight with condescension. "Well," I said, smiling, but firm, "maybe we can do your spot on Father's Day? Today's mine." That was the spark. His phone hit my cheekbone with the weight of all his buried rage. I heard a crunch, felt warmth, and then saw red drip onto my blouse like slow, cruel raindrops. He said nothing, just stared like I'd spilled ketchup on myself by accident. In the ER, the nurse asked if I wanted to press charges. I told her no. My daughter was asleep at her grandmother's. I didn't want to shake her world. But that wasn't the first time. That man had an obsession with humiliation. He'd make me serve his coffee, and if it was too hot, too cold, or just because his jaw felt tight that morning, he'd knock it over. "Oops," he'd sneer. "Clean it. With your tongue." And I did. On my knees, in my own house, with tears mixing into espresso stains, I did. Because when you're drowning, you drink salt water and call it hydration. He told people that I was dramatic, that I liked rough play, that I had a temper. And I stayed quiet. Lies are sticky when whispered often enough. Then came the Tuesday he forgot to log out of his email, a thread with someone named Jenna. She called him Daddy CEO and thanked him for the necklace, said she loved their secret weekend in Tahoe. I didn't scream. I forwarded every email to myself, took photos of the gifts in his drawer, and copied financial records. That night, I kissed him on the cheek. "I'm making your favorite tomorrow," I said. "Slow roasted ribs." The next day, while he was out, I left. Took our daughter, went straight to a lawyer, filed a police report, filed for custody, froze his accounts. He called me a psycho, said I was trying to ruin him. I smiled through the courtroom windows. Years passed. I started my own brand, took what I knew, pain, manipulation, image, and built something out of it. A clothing label for women like me, women who crawled through glass and now wore stilettos over the scars. I got rich. Now I live in a penthouse in Manhattan, floor-to-ceiling glass, whiskey shelf that makes bartenders weep. Two men in rotation. One's an ex-personal trainer from Miami. The other's a hedge fund dropout with perfect abs and no backbone. I call them my boys. "Babe," I say, swirling Yamazaki 18 in a crystal tumbler, "you spilled the kombucha." They freeze, look at each other. "What do we do?" the hedge funder asks. "Lick." They get on their knees, eager, pathetic, beautiful. Sometimes I laugh, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I put on Nina Simone, stretch out on my velvet couch, and snap my fingers. They dance, strip, bark if I ask. One night, the trainer asked, "Do you love us?" I looked at him, really looked. "You're a reflection, a funhouse mirror. You do for me what I used to do for someone who mistook cruelty for dominance," he nodded. Once I brought out the same brand of coffee my ex used to drink. I brewed it, handed it to the trainer. He took a sip, winced. "Too hot." I smiled, knocked the cup onto the floor. "Oops." He dropped to his knees, and I watched him clean it. And for the first time in years, I didn't feel like the girl with blood on her blouse. I felt like the goddamn author of the next chapter. You want a happy ending? This is mine. This story was shared by one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers. It happened to her 4 years ago. In her life story, the husband was a complete menace. And yes, he did throw the phone at her. Every day, she thought that things would improve and that this is just a passing phase, but they never did. Eventually, she left the house.
I always thought Mother's Day would feel different. Growing up, I imagined soft breakfasts in bed, scribbled cards with shaky crayon hearts, maybe even a bouquet if I got lucky. What I didn't expect was a stale room, silence, and the slow wheeze of my husband trying to breathe without flinching.
"Sorry, babe,"
he grunted, lying flat on the couch.
"This rib thing is killing me."
Yeah, so was the silence. To be fair, he did let me sleep in, which felt like heaven after six straight nights of baby colic. He even fed Ava and changed her diaper without waking me, which for him was like winning the damn Nobel Prize. But by noon, reality kicked in. No card, no acknowledgement, not even a happy first Mother's Day. Not even a hug. We didn't have money. I didn't expect gifts, but I did expect something. A moment, maybe, where he looked me in the eyes and saw me. The woman who tore her body open for his child. The woman still up at 3 a.m. every night. But instead, he just lays there, groaning and scrolling TikTok. So I did what any emotionally reckless woman with a smartphone and a bruised heart would do. I messaged my high school crush, Tyler James. The guy every girl wanted and every teacher rolled their eyes at. He was in town, he said. Some kind of real estate mogul now, with tailored suits and tequila tastings, and an apartment overlooking Lake Michigan. We hadn't spoken in almost a decade, but he replied within minutes. Brunch? One word, no punctuation. Classic Tyler. I should have said no, but I didn't. I told my husband I needed some me time, and left him with Ava and a bottle of pump milk. He didn't even ask where I was going. Tyler showed up in a matte black Mercedes outside of a trendy spot in Lincoln Park. He was tan, lean, and smirking like the last 10 years hadn't touched him. "You look like someone's fantasy MILF," he said, pulling me into a hug. "Thanks," I replied, rolling my eyes. "You look like you just sold the building." "I did. Two of them." Over brunch, he told me about his Miami condo, his startup, the beach parties with crypto weirdos. I laughed too loudly, drank too much, said things I shouldn't have. Then came the hotel. A rooftop suite at the Pendry. Ava's face flashed in my mind as the elevator doors closed. I should have gone home. Instead, I leaned in. We didn't talk for 3 days. Then came the text. "I can't stop thinking about you." I ignored it. I meant what I said. What had he said? I didn't even remember. Something about how I deserve better. How I shouldn't be invisible in my own home. Standard affair pillow talk. "I want you. I want you and Ava. I want to build something real." That was when the cold dread crept in. I typed out a long message telling him it was a mistake, that I love my husband, that it was just a stupid moment. But before I could hit send, another message came through. "I did something for you." My fingers froze. I went on the dark web. I found someone. I stared at the screen, unable to blink. "Don't freak out, just listen." He called me. I let it ring 6 times before picking up.
"Tyler, what the hell?"
"Babe, breathe. It's already done." "What's done?" "I hired someone. He's going to take care of your husband. Discreetly. No mess. He has this..."
"What are you saying right now?"
"There's this package.
It's insane. They don't just clean up, they deliver. You and Ava will be relocated. I paid for the full thing. I told them to bring you both to me."
I couldn't speak. My throat burned.
"Tyler, are you insane?"
"No, I'm in love." I hung up and vomited in the sink. Shaking, I locked the nursery door and sat in the rocking chair, staring at my daughter's tiny chest rise and fall. 2 days later, a black SUV parked outside my house. I never saw the driver, but when I opened the mailbox, there was an envelope. No return address, just my name. Inside was a burner phone. It rang that night. The voice spoke, clean and mechanical. "Ma'am, confirmation required for package execution. Reply 1 for yes, 2 for terminate." I slammed the phone down and smashed it with a hammer. I told myself this was a hallucination, a sick prank. But the next morning, my husband didn't wake up. He didn't groan, didn't scroll, just didn't. I called 911, screamed CPR instructions into the void, and watched them wheel his pale, cold body away. No wounds, no signs. Natural causes, they said. But I knew better. For the next 7 days, I barely slept. I couldn't eat, couldn't think. I kept replaying the conversation in my head. It's already done. He had said it so casually, like ordering takeout. I didn't tell anyone, of course. What could I say? That I cheated on my husband and the guy I did it with killed him as some twisted love gift? No, I stayed quiet. I put on black leggings, wrapped Ava in her softest blanket, and went through the funeral like a polite grieving wife. People whispered about how sudden it was, how tragic. So young, they said. So healthy. I nodded, smiled faintly, and pretended my insides weren't made of acid and wire. But every night, I locked the doors, checked the windows, and slept with the baby monitor on full volume and a kitchen knife under my pillow. My eyes were always on the street, watching for that same black SUV. And then came day 8. The message popped up while I was nursing Ava, her tiny hand wrapped around my finger like a lifeline. "Hey, you're amazing, but I don't think I'm feeling that spark anymore. I hope we can both walk away with no drama and good memories. Wishing you and the baby the best." That was it. I stared at the screen, mouth open. The world spun. My breath turned jagged. He wasn't feeling the spark anymore? After everything? After my husband was dead? I waited for a follow-up. A joke. An apology. Something. But nothing ever came. This story was inspired from the real-life story shared by one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers. She says that she had a completely different image of marriage and motherhood in her head. On her first Mother's Day, when her husband didn't show much enthusiasm, she was sad but understood as he was still recovering from an injury. But 2 Mother's Days have passed since then and things have been dull. Same has been the case with her marriage, and she's feeling stuck. She wrote me asking for advice. "My dear Broccoli Fam, what do you think she should do? Your replies would be helpful, as I'm sure she'll watch her animated story and read your advice."
I never meant for it to go this far. Not when I Googled how to disappear and start over. Not when I bought that burner phone. Not even when I left the note on the kitchen counter. "Gone for a walk. Love you." The news said I was kidnapped. The whole town lit candles, prayed for my return, posted my smiling face on every lamppost from here to El Paso. The irony? I was watching it all on my girlfriend's 85-inch OLED in a gated neighborhood 3 towns over, sipping red wine. I was a suburban mother of 2, married to a man who never hit me, but he may as well have. Every day with him felt like a slow bruise. Matt loved routine, loved sameness, loved his job more than he ever loved me. I played the role of the perfect wife. I packed the lunches, I wore the smile, but behind that smile I was dying. Then came Ava. She was chaos wrapped in Chanel, a criminal defense lawyer who knew how to work a courtroom and a bedroom. We met at a women's empowerment seminar, of all places. She touched my wrist during a laugh, and the static in my spine never left. "You ever think about running?" she'd asked once over coffee. I laughed then, nervous, curious, terrified. I planned the escape for 8 months. Ava helped. She paid off an old friend to stage a break-in, left the window open, smeared the blood, stole my wedding ring. The detective was a rookie. He bought it all. For 3 months, Ava and I lived like the world owed us freedom. She took me to rooftop restaurants, private screenings, art shows where I pretended to know what abstraction meant. Love with her was like music on acid. My body had never felt like mine until it was in her hands. But then the silence started to hum. I stopped checking the news. I stopped reading the books she gave me. I started walking to the local gas station just to smell burnt coffee and hear men complain about taxes. I wanted something ugly, real. Ava didn't notice at first. Too busy with court and her trainer. But one night she came home early. "Are you working at a gas station?" she said, her voice too calm. "I wanted something different," I replied. "Something real." She stared at me for a long time. Then she laughed. "You always want what you don't have. That's your sickness." She wasn't wrong. I started saving my tips in a coffee can under the sink. I read up on sadhvis, women who renounce the world, live in caves in the Himalayas, eat once a day, and pray to nothing. That sounded better than living a lie, again. But then Matt found me. He burst into the station with the kids in the car, tears streaming down his face, saying I ruined everything, that I owed him, that our children cried every night. "You're coming home," he said. "This ends now." "You don't own me," I screamed. I don't remember the drive home. Just the look in his eyes were enough to press me down into the car seat. Matt didn't say much that night. Didn't have to. He made lasagna. He served the dinner. He smiled like a man who'd won. And when the house went quiet and the clock ticked past 11, he came into our bedroom and pulled the candle from the nightstand drawer. "You broke us," he whispered, as though it were a prayer. Then the wax poured. It stung, and then it didn't. Pain has a funny way of numbing out when it becomes routine. I didn't scream, not after the first week. He always cleaned it up, patched my skin in silence, kissed my forehead like I was some kind of pet. He'd whisper, "Don't make me do this," as though the blame still lived with me. I hid the burns under long sleeves and watched the walls close in. Ava stopped calling. I think she knew. Or maybe she didn't care. The only thing that tethered me to that house were two little faces. Soft, confused, aching for answers I couldn't give. They'd knock softly on my bedroom door some mornings, and I'd already be up, pretending to fold laundry, trying to look normal. Some nights I dreamed I never left. That the note on the counter had never been written. That Ava never existed. But I always woke up to wax on my skin. One Tuesday, my daughter came home from school with a drawing. It was of a house, a family, and a big red monster scribbled in the corner. Now, when I asked what it was, she just shrugged and said, "That's what lives here now." That night, Matt kissed the kids goodnight. Said, "Daddy's gonna read them a story, hun." I sat in the hallway, knees pulled to my chest, listening to his voice through the wall. When it was over, I went in, watched them sleep. They looked like angels, even in the chaos, even in the dark. I knelt beside their beds, kissed their foreheads. "I'm sorry," I whispered, my lips trembling against their warm skin. And that was it. I didn't pack a bag. I didn't leave a note. I didn't even take my wallet. Just the clothes on my back and a bus ticket paid in coins from a secret stash behind the dryer. I traveled east, hid in trains, begged for rides, took up small jobs in dabas and roadside ashrams. No name, no story, just one rule: keep moving. Eventually, the roads narrowed, the buildings grew sparse, and I found myself in Rishikesh, surrounded by 100 versions of peace I never thought I'd deserve. I shaved my head with a kitchen knife, burned every piece of clothing I'd worn under him, and started again. A year passed like a dream, or a deep sleep. I woke up every morning before dawn, washed my body, ate boiled rice, learned to sit still. I didn't talk much, didn't need to. The pain didn't leave, but it changed, softened, became part of the rhythm, like breath, like prayer, like silence. One morning, I was meditating under the fig tree, the air thick with incense and dew. A group of American tourists passed by. One of them, a woman with purple nails and a cannon around her neck, snapped a photo of me. "Look at her," she whispered. "She looks like peace." The photo went viral. She captioned it, "Peace looks like this." It was everywhere. Instagram, BuzzFeed, news portals. My sister sent it to Matt. He stared at it for hours. Tried to zoom in on the scar that ran from my shoulder to elbow. The one he gave me. But I wasn't his anymore. I don't know if I'll ever go back. To America, to that house, to that name. But I know this. I am not someone's wife. I am not someone's mother. I am not someone's mistake to correct. I am breath. I am silence. I am the woman in that photo. And peace, for once, looks like me. In November of 2016, Sherry Papani, a 34-year-old mother of two from Redding, California, vanished while out for a jog. Her sudden disappearance triggered a nationwide search. 3 weeks later, she reappeared on Thanksgiving Day, bruised, bound, and claiming that she had been abducted by two women. Her story sparked widespread sympathy and media attention. However, in 2020, investigators uncovered that Papani had been staying with an ex-boyfriend and had harmed herself to support the abduction hoax. Her motives were linked to escaping marital and personal responsibilities. In 2022, she pleaded guilty to making false statements and mail fraud, having accepted nearly $300,000 in victim assistance funds. She was sentenced to 18 months in prison and ordered to pay restitution, becoming a national symbol of deceptive crime.